Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hey folks, Kaiser here. We've got a new initiative at SupChina that I want to tell you about because I suspect many of our listeners are just the sort of people we want to get involved. And it's a chance for you China nerds to parlay your arcane knowledge into a little income. We've launched a consulting and expertise marketplace called SupChina Direct. The goal is to connect the best China-focused talent with the companies and organizations who need support for their China-related projects and initiatives. Think of us as the Airbnb of highly qualified, deeply experienced China professionals. We've already built out a pretty decent network, a couple of hundred independent consultants and boutique consulting firms. We're really looking for people who know healthcare, consumer and retail, macroeconomics, and of course, technology. And if your business is looking for experts in those or pretty much any other fields, for anything from market entry to due diligence to digital marketing to supply chain sourcing, just get in touch. So whether you're a subject area specialist who wants to pitch new clients, or if you're looking for just the right specialist yourself, go to www.subchina.direct and sign up today. Now on with the show. Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SupChina. SupChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of different sources, plus links to the original writing on our own website. Sign up for SupChina Access, and you get all that and much more with stories and everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, well over a million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am coming to you today from Washington, D.C. Joining me from behind the thickets and brambles of an increasingly ridiculous beard is SupChina's editor-in-chief, Jin Yumi, known in the as-yet uncynicized world as Jeremy Goldcorn. Jeremy, say hello to our listening audience, won't you, if they can hear you.
What? Listening audience? Isn't an audience by definition listening? And going after my beard is a low blow, Kaiser. But hello, or listening audience. Or vomiting audience, or whatever you're doing.
So on July 3rd, the Washington Post published an open letter signed at the time of publication by about 100 prominent people in policy and academic world, in business and defense. The letter was authored by people I greatly admire, Taylor Fravel of MIT, who was on this show quite recently talking about his book on China's military strategy, by the eminent Ezra Vogel, who authored the magisterial tome on Deng Xiaoping, former ambassador and eminent screech of China policy circles Stapleton Roy, and Susan Thornton, who's also been on Seneca, and who was, of course, the acting assistant secretary of state for East Asia Pacific Affairs until not too long ago. But the main driving force, if I'm not mistaken, was Michael D. Swain, who is a prominent analyst of Chinese security studies, and he's now a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Michael is a senior policy analyst at the RAND Corporation and has many years of experience in Chinese defense and foreign policy, and the numerous publications to show for it. We are delighted that Michael could join us as our guest this week on Seneca. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Kaiser.
So full disclosure, before we get started, I am a signatory on the letter, not one of the names printed in the Washington Post, but I have since signed it. And also full disclosure, Jeremy, you did not sign the letter, did you? And you've got a couple issues with it as you're going to want to raise as our discussion proceeds.
Sure.
Anyway, Michael, great that you could join. Let's start with this. So the hawkishness that we have in D.C., it's been discernible for quite some time, right? What explains why only now, in the middle of 2019, did you decide that it was time to organize such an effort?
Well, I think that even though the there has been some elements of what you would call hawkishness in U.S. policy for some time, and these in some ways perhaps even extend back to the Obama administration. I think it's the case that most people with whom I have engaged on this issue have believed that under the Trump administration, this policy approach has become really extreme. It's not just sort of simply hawkish in a kind of generic way. It has become really kind of categorically opposed to almost everything China does. It's really verging on what I would call demonization. And you've seen that reflected in some of the policy documents that have come out of the Trump administration. I think it's what I usually say in describing it is it's an extreme version of the kind of bipartisan shift that we have seen in regarding China over the last several years, which has been towards that of seeing China more as a rival and a competitor than as a potential partner in some ways. And the Trump administration, I think, has just taken that to a very extreme end, barely ever mentioning the idea that there may be issues with which we can cooperate with the Chinese or work with them. It's all sort of this one-note drumbeat of negative behavior about what the Chinese are doing, saying, thinking, their policies, etc.
Right, right, right. I would certainly agree with it that it has taken a more extreme turn during this time. But if you look back at that period, the Obama administration, I mean, I think a lot of people would date the downturn really to 2008, 2009, to the immediate, you know, the early days of the financial crisis, the immediate post-Olympic period, where you started to see more assertive behavior by China and sort of a responsive behavior by the United States in like phone ops and things like that. A few years later, you already have the pivot or the rebalancing, which is, you know, seen by everyone in China, everyone I've ever talked to, certainly, as at least some species of containment. Mm-hmm. So it certainly was there before, but you don't think that it sort of merited an organized effort to steer back on course, as it were?
Well, no. At that time, I had my complaints about the Obama policy in various ways. I wasn't a big fan of the idea of the pivot, particularly what it was called. But I didn't see the kind of one-dimensional extreme approach to interpreting what China is and what it's doing in the world today that you see under Trump. I mean,
certainly
it's just
not
a big contrast. So
Trump would never have said what Obama said, that, you know, a strong, stable and prosperous China is good for the United States.
Right.
Right, right.
Right. The idea of a constructive partnership, as it was often described, or much less the idea that Jim Steinberg had during the Trump Obama administration, that we need to have strategic reassurance in both directions. I mean, the idea of reassurance or mutual accommodation is completely, you know, alien to the Trump administration.
Exactly.
Michael, can you tell us a bit about the who and the why of the letter? Who were the principal authors of the first draft? And maybe a little bit about the background, not so much the principal authors, but the signatories in terms of academic, diplomatic, business, military, or other experience. Is it predominantly academics and policy wonks behind it?
Well, I wouldn't say it's academic. Well, if you mean by policy wonks, if you mean former officials, then yes, former officials were involved in developing and certainly signing this letter. I mean, it began really as part of a conversation online among a group of us who are involved in China issues, particularly China foreign policy, security related issues. And there's been a lot of back and forth over the years and since the Trump administration came into office about their policies. And so, you know, I have at various times sort of posted things saying, you know, people need to say something about this. People need to really speak up more. Because when you're sitting here in Washington, you really get the impression there's just this deluge of constant 24/7, you know, let's get China stuff that goes on and on and on. And there's just like very little that's written out there that really tries to put things in something like a database perspective. And so I said, you know, let's try and do something like this. Maybe we can get some kind of statement together. And so I drafted a statement originally, and it was much longer than what it is now, of course, and too detailed. I tend to write too much. And then I submitted it to a group of people that was beyond the five people who had their signatures on the letter. It was about 20 people,
I see,
basically online, and a variety of different people, including scholars, policy analysts at think tanks, former officials, a few business people, that sort of thing. And then it just sort of developed from there. We revised it many, many times up and down. It went down at one time to about like one or two sentences for each of the propositions. And then it sort of grew a little bit. And then we decided we more or less could all live with it. I mean, nobody was 100%, yeah, I agree with every single word, but they believed in the basic thrust of the document, which was to call attention to what we thought were some very, you know, counterproductive, by being too extreme, policies of the Trump administration. And it's not just the Trump administration. I mean, it's kind of like the mindset that's
the blob.
Yeah, right. That's very dominant in Washington now. I mean, it wasn't really a specific attack on the Trump administration per se, although they certainly are in many ways illustrating this. But it was an attack really on that frame of mind.
And Michael, why was it published? To whom exactly was it aimed, and what do you hope the results will be?
Well, I think it was published because the Washington Post saw it as newsworthy. I mean, they recognize that there's been very little of this kind of statement coming out of Washington and other places, and certainly nothing like this, an open letter signed by 100 people. I mean, it clearly showed that there is no dominant consensus among the, you know, serious policy community, not just China watchers. There are people who signed this letter who were not China watchers per se. They were foreign policy people, business people. So it wasn't just China watchers. But the main point of the letter was really to convey, as it said at the very end of the letter, to convey the point that there is no single dominant hardline consensus about China in Washington and among sort of the foreign policy community. And I think that was shown very clearly by the fact that you've got this letter that's now over 160 signatories that from people in different walks who are serious, interested in China, foreign affairs, business with China, etc.
There were some surprising names, actually, as I was perusing it the other day. Some people who I never would have thought would have signed on to such a thing, but very glad to see that they did. Let's talk specifically about some of the content of the letter. I fully understand the need that a lot of us who are concerned about this sort of get tougher on China line. I understand the need for us to kind of give a full litany of criticisms of Beijing before we make our case. I think a cynic might allege that we're doing that just to inoculate ourselves against the criticism, that we're naive, that we don't have our eyes open, that we're romanticizing China in some way. But I've certainly done a lot of that kind of caveating myself. And I kind of reflexively include it in any talk that I give now on recent U.S. policy. Jeremy, you've made it pretty clear that you don't think this litany was complete enough or maybe harsh enough, and that it didn't mention a few issues in particular. Do you want to address that now? What issues do you think should have been included? And then, Michael, perhaps you can talk about the decision to include what you did and to not include what you didn't.
Okay, well,
Jeremy?
I don't think there's a need to insert a litany for reasons of appearance or to fend off criticism. And I believe there are quite a few of the signatories are people who are known in recent years for their criticism of China. I don't think there's any need to prove that. My own point of view, and I don't know how widely this is shared, is that I think when you publish a letter titled China is Not an Enemy in the Washington Post, you know that while it might be ignored by the blob in D.C., it's going to be lapped up by eager eyes in Beijing and subsequently used for propaganda, which in fact did happen. So I think putting such a letter together, there was a remarkable opportunity to focus some attention in Zhongnanhai on some of the more egregious abuses the party is currently perpetrating, especially because both are happening with little resistance from the international community. And the two that come to my mind first, and maybe there are others that should be on this list, but, you know, the concentration camps in Xinjiang. And the other one of concern, and I think would be a natural fit in this letter, is Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, the two detained Canadians, detained in revenge for the arrest of the Huawei CFO and now subject to petty torture, like having their eyeglasses confiscated. These two people, or any one of the signatories of the letter, could have found themselves in such a situation, and the two are being abandoned by their government. So for me, there was just this lost opportunity to actually focus Beijing's attention and global attention on some issues that matter. I don't think it was a litany. So that's my little rant about that subject.
Michael?
Well, I mean, I think they're fair points. You can argue about, you know, how explicit we should have been, how strong our language should have been in addressing what the Chinese are doing. I don't think there was any intent or desire to kind of like throw a softball at the Chinese by describing their behavior the way we did in the letter. There was a lot of back and forth about different ways of phrasing this. I can't really speak for my co-signers, but my perspective is that I think we were trying to sort of cast the orbit a little bit wider, trying to sort of address the sort of broader kind of generic problems that we have. And we mentioned the idea of domestic repression in the letter. And I know that sounds weak to a lot of people. We should have been more explicit and listed this, 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 and this.
Or at least maybe the word domestic ethnic repression.
Yeah, right.
So it would have been clear that you were referring
to Tibetans. Right, we probably should have said that. In fact, I thought we had written that in there. I would probably have said we should have written that in there, but it ended up not getting in there. And I don't think it was because anybody said, hey, we don't want to mention Xinjiang. I mean, I can't recall anybody saying that. So, you know, it was a question of how do you best characterize what you think to be the worst or most egregious kind of areas where China is causing problems for the United States and others, while at the same time keeping the focus on what the letter is. I mean, the focus of the letter was U.S. policy towards China. And the basic point was the Chinese are doing a lot of bad things that are contributing to this downward spiral, but the Trump administration is doing a lot of things that are really making it worse, not better. And it was that kind of point in trying to push back against what I said before, which is this apparent consensus that everybody has agreed what China is and how do we deal with it, that was the primary point of the letter.
I would add something to that. I would say that we have to remember that when you are basically, as this letter does, arguing the case for engagement, just remember we don't talk about a strategy of engagement with our allies or with countries that share our values and our behavioral norms. We don't talk about engagement with Japan, engagement with South Korea, engagement with Canada or the UK. We use that word specifically when it is a regime that we have serious issues with, where we think that there's a huge values chasm and that a bridge needs to be built out. So I get it. But there was another line of criticism that I thought was really kind of interesting. I heard from one individual. He asked me that not to use his name. He actually declined to sign the letter in large part because the criticisms on the list, specifically economic ones, he thought had gone too far, that it should have included language about the WTO commitments that China did honor. In his words, and this is him, this is why they are our largest agricultural market and why GM and Boeing sell more cars and planes there than in the U.S. So he acknowledges that China hasn't done everything they agreed to do in 2001 and that we do need to press on some of these issues where market access has not been given. But he also adds that if we don't acknowledge that they've done a lot, we really give up the opportunity to argue that engagement has worked and for the U.S. and for most Chinese citizens. He also has a quibble with the line about the party exerting new control over private firms, which he describes as a popular notion that, as far as he can tell, isn't accurate. So what do you make of that criticism? I know you're fending stuff off from both sides, but...
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there was somebody who did sign the letter who said to me that he was going to sign the letter, but he emphatically thought we should have put in more information to show how U.S.-China trade relations has benefited the American public.
Yeah, and I would like to see that too.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's really a question here of how much you can get in and how much you want to really fit into a document like this. I sort of think that the point two, which begins with we do not believe Beijing is an economic enemy or an existential national security threat in every way, that was in part intended to try to get at that point, that we're not dealing with a simple categorically, you know, predatory economic entity, as the White House tends to describe it. Yes, there are things that the Chinese are doing economically that we don't like and which are not in line with WTO commitments and which, you know, a lot of businessmen are complaining about, which they haven't in the past. And those are valid things. And those are things,
absolutely, yeah.
Those are things that need to be addressed, and the Chinese should recognize this, and there needs to be an effective way of dealing with these. But the sledgehammer approach of the White House and their sort of categorical denial that there's anything positive in U.S.-China economic relations. I mean, even there seems to be even an effort out of some in the White House to decouple the Chinese economy from the U.S. economy, break up the supply chains,
get
American companies to get out of China and other foreign companies as well. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, I don't know a single serious economist who thinks that this is either A, feasible, or B, would be useful for the United States or for other economies. But of course, it's based upon this one-dimensional, categorical, you know, hair on fire notion that the Chinese are this predatory economic entity that's out to screw everybody except themselves, which is a cartoon. I mean, it's just a fundamentally cartoonish depiction of what China is.
Michael, let's talk about another line of criticism, perhaps best articulated in an op-ed written by John Pomfret in response to the letter. If I may summarize brutally and, you know, without any nuance, the argument is that your letter assumes too much influence on the part of the United States and somehow deprives China of agency. Part of this argument, and, you know, I agree with this, is the idea that the U.S. taking a softer line on China empowers reformers. From my perch in Beijing from 1995 until 2015 and immersing myself in Chinese news every day since then, to me, the last reformer who actually had any power was Zhu Rongji. And since Zhu and Zhang's retirement, the only type of Chinese leader that has gained any power has been in the mold of Bo Xilai and Xi Jinping, no matter what America did.
What about Wen Jiabao?
Well, I mean, that was a caretaker administration. They let things slide, and as soon as things got a little dangerous, they clamped down. You know, I remember the Wenming Banwang campaign against bloggers in 2006. It was a early incarnation of later crackdowns on Weibo. I mean, there was no institutional reform that happened during that period. They just kicked the can down the road.
But for the 5 years before, they had allowed this almost unfettered expansion of the public sphere, especially online. They had
tolerated it, but they didn't, right. It wasn't by planning. I mean, it wasn't an actual reform. It was what happened because of economic growth and the internet.
I think there was quite a deliberate policy undertaken to allow it.
Kaiser, we'll have to agree to disagree on this one. Let Michael respond.
Yeah. So what do you say about this empowerment of reformers bit?
Well, I think we really have to define our terms, what we mean by reformers. If you think that the argument means there are people in the Chinese Communist Party who really think the Communist Party shouldn't be leading China and there should be some kind of pluralist, liberal political system, you're not going to find many reformers in the Communist Party at the senior levels. I think it really has more to do with what are the kinds of policies internationally and domestically that would best advance China's interests. And here you've got a policy from Xi Jinping, which is, frankly, more hardline, more Leninist, if you will, than has his predecessors have been.
Absolutely.
He's more dependent on party controls. He's more dependent on ideology. He's using more, I think, repressive means domestically in particular. And I don't think everybody in the leadership necessarily believes that this is all correct. I mean, they're going along with it in part because they owe things to Xi Jinping or because they don't have an easy alternative to it or because they're concerned about the problems that rapid development is creating within China. And so they're willing to condone it. But, you know, I think it's naive to assume that there is not differences of that there are not differences of opinion about how China should move forward in trying to conduct development, growth, et cetera, while trying to carry out something in some way, meaning reform, meaning in order to try to engage more directly with the outside world through the market mechanism, through other political means, et cetera, that would advance China's interests. I mean, I think it's fundamental that there are differences and debates that go on within the Chinese system. Under Xi Jinping today, they are certainly less common, I think, and they're certainly less evident. But that's not to say that they're not there. I mean, I talk with a fair amount of Chinese who are not at the top of the system by any means, but they have some access to the system. And, you know, there a lot of people come through Washington, too. They're not happy with what they're seeing going on in China today. Now, they're not standing committee members of the Politburo, but I'm not talking necessarily about the next year, the next 2 years of Xi Jinping's rule. I mean, we got to talk about the longer term evolution of China here. And on that basis, I think what Xi Jinping is doing today in China really is counterproductive in the extent to which he's focusing on ideology and party controls and such. I think ultimately it's going to come back and shoot him in the foot, because if he wants a truly innovative, truly advanced 21st century economy for China that's really involved in the global economy, he can't do that by compartmentalizing and segmenting off whole sectors of society in China. It's just ultimately, it's not going to work for China. It's not going to be an efficient way to try and develop.
Right. I mean, when I read that line in the letter about the emboldening reformers or about sort of a more bellicose posture on our part, bringing the hawks in China to the fore, I kind of knew that was going to be a red rag in front of certain types. I just sort of anticipated that they were going to do that. And for that reason, I might not have included such language. I mean, for some reason, it just drives people bonkers. I don't know why. I think the jury's still out as to what. I mean, I think that, again, defining terms, if you're going to strawman this and say that what we're talking about is a Gorbachev, of course not. That's just sort of ridiculous. But unfortunately, there have been people.
Well, even Gorbachev himself did not necessarily intend for the CPSU to be overthrown.
Kaiser and Michael, you have a little sidestep the question of, okay, even if you agree that there are reformers who actually may, in different circumstances, be empowered, whether now or in 5 years' time, does the United States posture, is that all? I mean, how much agency do these people have themselves, no matter what the United States does? I mean, I think that's the heart of the question.
Well, let me get to that. Let me tell you what I think about that. But first, I got to say, look, it may not be the case that this would empower moderates, but it certainly is the case that bellicosity on our part would bring the hardliners to the fore. So, look, there's this other kind of weirdly widely accepted notion that the Chinese respond only to strength, that the chi ying bu chi ruan is the phrase. I don't believe that this is well founded. I think that it's a very pervasive notion, but it seems to me to be one that people derive just from experience, in dealing individually, usually in business settings with Chinese people, and they somehow extrapolate it to the entirety of the leadership. But anyway, back to your question, Jeremy. I actually have no problem at all with the United States taking a pretty hefty amount of credit for recognizing this very simple truth that Beijing does pay very close attention to what we say and what we do in the United States. We have an outsized role in shaping China and Chinese behavior. I think that the argument that Pomfret advances and other people I've seen advance is just sort of this falsely modest one. And by the way, it's one that I think is kind of disingenuous, because these same people who are all about the big swinging dick of American policy are suddenly really worried about infringing on Chinese agency. Oh, come on. I mean, that to me is just kind of ridiculous. But okay. I think you've
reduced the view to a cartoon, but go on.
Okay, anyway, I think we need to embrace the idea that most Americans want to see a China that is more open, that is more deliberative, that is more tolerant, that's more participatory. And we shouldn't be shy about that fact. We just need to calibrate our interactions at both the state-to-state and at the individual level in such a way that our counterparts there, don't think that we're trying to undermine them. But, we have values, right? And if we don't, I mean, Christ, I don't believe that our negotiations should simply be, pure realpolitik. That's absurd. Values matter.
I mean, it's interesting. When I've talked to several Chinese about this whole question about how the Chinese at the senior levels look at the United States now, and particularly the turn towards this more hardline view in the Trump administration. And I mean, I'm often told that, I mean, there are different views on this, and that the Xi Jinping view, as best as people can discern it, is not really on the one extreme. I mean, there is an extreme view that says exactly what you just suggested, Kaiser, which is, what have we told you all along? The United States has always wanted to contain China, and it's insecure about its own position internationally, and so now we're seeing the manifestation of this in the Trump administration, the clearest, simplest, so it's a confirmation. So we need to really, really address the United States as this kind of, categorical zero-sum adversary, et cetera. And they've always wanted to contain us, so they're going to try and undermine us. Even if we're not communists, they'll try and undermine us.
Right.
Because they can't have another power that can challenge them. And then there's a point of view that's on the other extreme, which is basically that, we need to, yes, the United States is doing all kinds of extreme things, and we can't be taken advantage of, et cetera, but we need to also reflect on what we've been saying and doing, and that we're not entirely blameless in some of the ways we manage some issues, from the South China Sea to perhaps Taiwan, some trade issues, et cetera. And we need to be more cognizant of this. It's not just the United States. There's a lot of countries around the world that are concerned by what China's doing.
And that's a viewpoint that actually gets out into the press once in a while,
too. That's a viewpoint, but I wouldn't say it's anything approaching a majority viewpoint. It's a minority viewpoint. And then there's the middle ground, and that's a very big middle ground in China, which I would say is probably Xi Jinping may actually be in that middle ground, not in terms of domestic
toward policies, one end of it,
but in terms of foreign policy.
Right.
That is to say, he recognizes, or I think he thinks that, you know, China can't get out of the world. It can't unintegrate from the world. It's got to keep on trying to work with the world. And there are very concrete reasons why the United States and China, even though they may not like each other in terms of values and such, they have to cooperate. And so if you recognize that fact, that there are still things that that the United States and China must deal with, and the United States must face this as well. So it's a certain reality that both sides must face. I was also told, very interestingly, that the Chinese leadership were kind of taken aback by the really rapidity and the extremity of the shift in the Trump administration against China, that they didn't quite they didn't really expect it. They didn't see it coming.
I've heard that too from multiple sources.
Yeah, have you heard that too?
Oh, absolutely.
Because they really were. And I asked a good friend of mine who's Chinese and who's often spoken to the government, how do you explain this? I mean, it's sort of like all over the media. And he said, well, you know, within China, I mean, the line is everything's got to be happy talk. I mean, everything's got to be really basically positive. Xi Jinping's line is succeeding. His policy is succeeding. And so, you know, this kind of contrary meme is sort of suggests, well, it's not really succeeding. I mean, it's really provoking a lot of adverse reactions. And so there is a sort of sense to sort of maybe live in a bubble. And so as a result, Xi Jinping apparently, at least according to this one person, said, I want to understand what's going on here. I want to understand what the origins of this thing is. How durable is it? You know, people say it's bipartisan, et cetera, et cetera. So there are a lot of Chinese now who are kind of sort of fanning out, talking with Westerners, for Americans in the U.S. and elsewhere. And a lot of Americans are being invited to come to China. And I think it's all part of this effort to sort of work through and say, okay, what exactly is driving this and how deep-rooted is it? And how should we respond to it? And I think that has sort of begun a kind of discussion within China about how to deal with this. The Chinese haven't published a defense white paper, by the way, since 2015, and they usually do it more frequently. And it could very well be in part because they're trying to sit back and say, exactly what are we dealing with here?
Support for this week's show comes from Brattle Street Educational Counseling. Stressed out about college applications, Brattle Street Educational Counseling can help. They provide guidance throughout the whole process and offer workshops for students looking to work in small groups at a rigorous pace. The workshops include hours of one-on-one attention. From college essays to standardized test prep to interviewing and applications, Brattle Street offers support for any student. Brattle Street, BRATTLE Street.com, helping you get where you want to go.
So, Michael, I had a conversation recently with a friend of mine who's a pretty astute observer of U.S.-China affairs, who said that part of the problem, the way he sees it, maybe even the very nub of the problem, is that from our side, anyway, the U.S. government, whether the State Department or whether the White House, just hasn't articulated explicitly what its goals are vis-a-vis China, not in any administration in the four decades since normalization. What he's saying is that, you know, this failure to do so has really hurt the side of engagement that has, you know, despite its long ascendancy, it's sort of left us vulnerable to these arguments that would involve what I would call a straw man, you know, caricature of the engagement position, you know, that we somehow believe that overnight China was going to transform into a liberal democracy with a full market economy. So, I mean, I pushed back, though. I suggested that maybe we shouldn't be so explicit, that not being explicit leaves a little bit of room for diplomacy, but also anyone paying attention can infer what it is that the U.S. wanted, and maybe it's best expressed in, you know, that formulation by Robert Zoellick, you know, the responsible stakeholder, that we basically want to, you know, if I had to spell it out, that we want to draw China deeply into this whole web of interconnectedness, so that because of all these interdependencies, it's both unable and unwilling to be a disruptive actor. It's going to buy into this post-war rules-based international order, or whatever we're calling it. No military expansion, no revanchism, no irredentism, no exporting radical ideology. And to that extent, I mean, it's been pretty good, right?
Yeah, but the problem, I mean, what I think is going on with the Trump administration, in fact, with many in Washington now, is that there is a fundamental rejection of that whole idea. And it is was kind of encapsulated by the recent piece that was written by Kurt Campbell and Eli Ratner.
Right.
You know, the basic argument, and I think it's been picked up by a lot of people, is that engagement, trying to do the things you just mentioned, Kaiser, et cetera, has failed. It simply failed. China has not evolved and developed in the way in which it needed to meet U.S. interests. And so U.S. policy, past U.S. policy, has generally been a failure. And therefore, we need to develop a new policy. And the Trump administration is kind of put out there as its new policy, essentially a one-dimensional policy. It's a policy
purely competitive.
Yeah, it's a policy of well, they call it competition, but it's far more than that.
Right.
It's really a deeply adversarial policy in many ways, although I'm not sure that Trump himself shares every element of that. It's really kind of weird when you hear Trump talk about his relationship with Xi Jinping and how the two countries are going to get along just great as soon as they make their great deal. His view about China seems to be very, very contradictory in a lot of ways.
Oh, I mean, he's got Bolton around him. He's got Bannon still in the wings. But then he has people below him.
Yeah. And, you know, when you look at the national defense strategy, national security strategy that both came out in 2017, 2018 by the administration, I mean, it's very clear what is going on. And that is, I think, an effort to say, okay, things have failed. We're dealing with a revisionist global power that wants to supplant the world order and dominate the world. And along with Russia and now probably Iran, they throw Iran in there. And now we have to develop a strategy for dealing with this. And that's the sort of free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, which is really not a strategy at all. It's just a slogan that talks about a set of objectives that it would like to see. The Japanese haven't signed on to the U.S. version now. They've backed away from it. The Indians haven't signed on to the U.S. version now. They've backed away from it. The Australians, I think, want to keep on everybody's side. So they're not saying much. But it's just not a strategy. And
the one-legged quad.
Yeah. And so you've got this kind of impulse. You've got an impulse that's attached to a bunch of formulations or interpretations of what China is, which is in many ways based upon, I think, you know, argument and not based upon data. It's just based upon views taken to an extreme. Some of it has elements of truth in it. Some of it is just way beyond anything you could find if you go out there and try and look at the reality of the situation, like the concept of debt trap diplomacy. I
certainly agree with what you've said, and it characterizes the Trump administration. But what I was really asking was sort of in a beyond Trump sense, what should we be saying in terms of an articulation of what we want from China?
Well, I think what we should be saying is we want from China a country with whom we can engage on issues that are vital to both countries and the world, that there are we want a China whose interests are going to be supportive of continued global economic growth and development. And then you try to define, you know, what are the requirements for that? And we want a China that is not bellicose and is not going to be intimidating through military arms its neighbors, that's not going to be trying to dominate in some untoward ways the countries around it, and that it needs to work with other parts of the international order in order to establish a more common approach to dealing with these security issues, economic issues, etc. I mean, I have long argued that in Asia, which is where the major security concern is, really, China does not pose a global national hard security threat. It poses primarily an Asia threat.
A regional threat
because of the growth of its military, because much of its military is oriented towards nullifying or neutralizing the ability of the United States to dominate the maritime space off its borders.
Right.
So because of that, you've got a basic contradiction. The United States thinks that order in the Western Pacific is best guaranteed by American predominance. The Chinese essentially reject that. They think there can be something other than that.
Would you extend this into the domestic realm? Would you also say that it should be part of American policy to want a China that signs on to international norms about human rights, about with its ethnic policy, about religious persecution, about, you know, torture, about jailing
dissenters? Oh, sure. I mean, I think that certainly would be, if you can bring that in line with the vast vast bulk of the global community. I mean, there was a whole lot of countries that just signed on to Xinjiang's repression of these ethnic minorities, including Saudi Arabia. I think the Philippines,
North Korea.
Anytime you find yourself on a list,
give
with
me
North
a break.
Korea,
so you've got the global part. I shouldn't say the global community, but you got part of the global community that's kind of endorsing this stuff in Xinjiang. So it's kind of hard to say the global community because they are really very divided about questions of human rights and political rights. But nonetheless, I think the United States and other Western democracies need to keep pressing China on this and trying to do so through a collective action. Of course, this is all anathema to the Trump administration because they don't really care about collective action.
That's right. That's
they care about unilateral deal-making.
Right. It strikes me, a question for both of you, Kaiser and Michael, that there are two types of people who tend to have received this letter with less enthusiasm, I think. And I think on the one hand, there's a bit of a generational divide when it comes to U.S. policy towards China. And people in their 40s or older, kind of Gen X and boomers, people who started coming to China 80s and 90s, are much more willing to cut China slack. And of course, many of them are embedded in the establishment, so they have an interest in the status quo. But younger people who have come later and are closer to the ground have just seen growing repression. I also think that anyone who's done business practically, you know, not sitting in some far off boardroom, but if you've actually run a company in China, you feel somewhat different about some of these questions. Like the two of you were just discussing these very high level policy questions. But for a lot of people, I think it comes down to reciprocity. We've seen our businesses harassed. We've seen our friends' NGOs shut down. And Kaiser, you say this is just individual stories, but in the aggregate, there are so many of these stories that there is a very real groundswell of frustration. And I think it's among younger China watchers, and I think it's amongst the business community who, in some ways, I believe, really started the current wave of hostility to China. But do you think there is a generation divide? And do you think there is a divide between people who've been doing business and others?
Let me first say, I don't mean to be dismissive of the experiences of these people. And yeah, you're right, in the aggregate, they do amount to something. What I am worried about is individuals taking their own anecdotes and then extrapolating them of their own without sort of data support. So that there's a difference there. Anyway, please, Michael, go on.
I take your point, Jeremy. I think there is, to some extent, a generational difference among people, young people who have been spending a lot of time on the ground in China in recent years. Haven't seen the larger arc of development in China, although it's not unmitigated. I mean, it's not one-dimensional. I know young people who are China scholars who do not at all hold this more
absolutely,
hard-line
absolutely.
View.
I would never claim to speak for all young people, or to be be young for that
diverse.
Matter.
Right. I think it's diverse, but it might lean a little bit more in the direction of the younger people who have been on the ground in China because they see a lot of the repression firsthand. And that's an issue. And, you know, it's a concern the United States and other countries should have, and they do, I think. But it's not something that should necessarily define policy per se, where you're dealing with national interests and you've got to sometimes deal with countries that are not the best and certainly distasteful in some ways. And that's the sort of point that you can't contain and isolate. China is not like the Soviet Union in the 1950s or 60s. It's a much, much more integrated power. It's a much more sophisticated power. In many ways, it's a more open power than the Soviet Union ever was. But it does have a lot of problems, and particularly right now, it's got a lot of problems that it's carrying out as a result of some of Xi Jinping's policies. Let me just say a word about business and one other group, military. I was personally a little disappointed because we didn't have as many business and military people who signed on to this letter. And it wasn't for lack of trying. The business people in general are very, very, very cautious about signing on to any kind of thing like an open letter. It exposes them to criticisms, including from the Trump administration, and they're trying to deal with the Trump administration to get the Trump administration to be more rational in their approach to their economic issues. There are lots of business organizations, there are business organizations that are really concerned with the way the Trump administration is going with the tariff wars and the sledgehammer approach. Yes, they have concerns about China, but they don't think that they're being dealt with in the most effective way by the administration. Nonetheless, business interests, I think, really are cautious about signing on. They cite a fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, which means they need to be prudent. They need to be cautious in how they engage with the outside world. And so for them, this is like too much of a kind of partisan or risk-taking kind of a thing. So even though quite a few agreed with most, if not all, of what's in the letter, they just said, I can't sign it. I'm not going to sign it.
Right.
Military people, slightly different issue, I think. Now, I can't speak for all the military people, and it wasn't like a huge number. But, you know, I've known quite a few military people over the years in part of my work. And a lot of them were sympathetic, but a lot of them also were uneasy about signing something that seemed to be critical of the National Defense Strategy, which is a United States government national document. Even though, you know, they're retired, I think they felt like, you know, I don't want to be seen as kind of like going against my government, even though they may not be very sympathetic, if you see what I mean.
I mean,
sort of like a sense of patriotism there that they felt they might be seen as violating in some way. And then there were others who simply said, and I think this was maybe even most of the people, military, said, I just don't sign these kind of things, open letters like this. And that was true of other people as well who were sympathetic to it. But they just said, I don't sign these things.
There is that tradition of the services trying to be apolitical.
I mean, a good example is Ryan Haas at Brookings. Ryan is very, very sympathetic with the open letter, but he didn't sign it. And he just doesn't, he says in principle, he just doesn't believe in signing these open letters. And, you know, that's his view. And I respect it. I respect it a lot.
Okay.
But I know he, you know, he supports the letter.
Oh, he sure does. I mean, if you listen to the show that we did with him, it's, you know.
Now, let's talk about someone who would not support the letter. I guess you've both read the FT editorial by Janos Kornai, who is widely recognized as one of the economists who was most influential in setting China down the path of economic liberalization. He was particularly harsh. He talked about creating a monster in the manner of Mary Shelley's Dr. Frankenstein's monster. He goes so far as to compare Xi Jinping to Stalin. What did you make of that? And connected to it, if you don't believe China is a monster and the letter is titled China is not an enemy, how should we think of China? I mean, is Stephen Colbert's frenemy, is that the best description? How would you define the relationship?
Well, I think it's a relationship that is very hard to pigeonhole in one phrase. I mean, really, I'm not trying to sort of dodge your question, Jeremy, but I really don't like labels like this. China is in many ways a unique power. The United States has never dealt with a power like this. It has huge impact on the international stage. It does things that are, in fact, in American interests, but it does a lot of things that aren't in American or Western interests. So it's a complex issue. So how do you deal with it? You have to deal with it through a combination of different policies that are based upon a realistic assessment, as we said in the last proposition of the open letter, a realistic assessment of what your aspirations are and your resources are that you're capable of dealing with, a realistic assessment of what the Chinese are and what they want that's based on, to best you can develop it, a sense of fact data. So what my view would be a form of engagement. We certainly have to continue with a policy of engagement with China that recognizes where we need to cooperate with them and develop that as best as we can while competing with the Chinese and in some cases deterring them. Now that sounds like the old policy, but you know, the basic principles, underlying logic, principles of that old policy, I think are still valid. Would you implement elements of that policy today in the same exact way as the Obama administration did or the Bush administration? Probably not in some ways. Now, in some regards, I would say we need to implement policies that are more based upon the idea of mutual accommodation, particularly in the Western Pacific. And I stress the word mutual. Now, that's the problem with many people. They believe there's no such thing as mutual accommodation with the Chinese, because the Chinese will take what you give and they will pocket it and they will give you absolutely nothing in return. I think the historical record does not support that. When I wrote a book called America's Challenge several years ago, I interviewed 50 policymakers who had negotiated and dealt with the Chinese. And the common theme among many of them was the Chinese will behave based upon their national interests. Now, what are their national interests? Believe it or not, in every case, they are not set in stone. Their national interests can be influenced by what the United States and other countries do. So you have an opportunity to engage the Chinese and get them to do things that you would want to have them do, and they might recognize that they want to do. So it's leaving open that possibility that I think is essential in American policy, in which the Trump administration virtually, or I should say almost entirely, ignores.
In the 90s through the 2000s, China settled quite a number of its existing border claims with a number of, it borders 14 countries, which is the most of any country in the world except for the Soviet Union or Russia now. But it settled the majority of those, I think more than 70% of them, favorably to the counterparty. So I don't buy that idea. Jeremy, going back to your question, though, I mean, you did bring up that Janusz Korczak thing. That essay, I mean, it was very disturbing, of course, because of who he was and his role in setting China down the course of reform and opening. I think it's interesting that maybe he's gone beyond demonization. It's no longer, it's not monstrification. I think it's, we're talking about the monstrification of China, which is even more disturbing. That's funny because the same people who now we're not going to claim agency again. Wait.
It's interesting. I don't. I'm not familiar with the article, Jeremy. I'm sorry, but it's interesting to listen to what he says based on your summary of it, and then look at what the World Bank has said, which is that since 2008, 1/3 of global growth has been due to China. 1/3 of global growth. Now, is that a predatory economy? I mean, there obviously. It's fundamentally, that viewpoint is just fundamentally flawed because it is too simplistic. And if you just assume the Chinese are this economic juggernaut out to suppress everybody, it just is not supported by the facts, which is not to say that the Chinese are not misbehaving. And that's what people automatically do. Because I say what I just said, people jump to the opposite extreme and say, oh, you're excusing the Chinese in every case. Which I'm not doing.
It's easy for people to make a caricature out of what you said. You know, you've got a pretty active presence there on Twitter, and you're not always restrained. Anyway, Jeremy,
well,
you asked about
to be restrained. I mean, come on, Kaiser.
It's hard.
I'm polite. I don't engage in ad hominem attacks.
Right, Jeremy, you asked about what we call it now, but whatever we call it, I mean, I think most people have come to accept that the competitive dimensions of the relationship are going to be more prominent than the collaborative dimensions. I think neither you nor I nor Michael want to see the collaborative element completely eclipsed by competition. But competition can be taken too far, obviously. What are some of the guardrails, Michael, that we should be thinking about putting in place to keep inevitable competition from going off the rails, as it were?
Well, I think some of the guardrails have to do with recognizing common limits on how far you go in certain directions with certain policies. For example, security policy. I mean, I believe that in the Western Pacific, the guardrails have to do with non-use of force statements, particularly in the South China Sea. You know, the Chinese say, oh, well, we signed this declaration of conduct way back when, where everybody says they need to exercise restraint and non-use of force. I say, yeah, sure, but that's being violated at every turn. Not necessarily with shooting, kinetic sort of action, but efforts to try and stop people from doing things. And the Chinese are as active in this, if not more, than the Vietnamese and others are. But there needs to be some kind of a explicit affirmation of a refusal to use force to displace anybody from their occupied areas in the South China Sea, and, you know, a real commitment to try to establish a set of guidelines there. And this shouldn't be led by the United States necessarily, but I think it needs to involve the United States because the United States is the biggest concern for the Chinese, I think, in the South China Sea. But that's just one example. In other areas, I think there has to be guidelines that are established multilaterally, for example, at WTO. I am a supporter of going back and revising the WTO and making it more modern, more up-to-date, to be able to include a lot of these high-tech and other areas that are just not very well addressed by the WTO. I mean, there are bases for, you know, argument and interpretation in the WTO, and I think it's too vague in some ways. And I think they need to have better means to define what are violations of trade and to enforce them, or at least to point them out. And the process is way too slow
Very good.
For
yeah,
doing this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Michael, there was another letter written, I think, by Kimo Fannell, who is part of the Committee on Present Danger, China, Frank Gaffney's organization, which Steve Bannon is also deeply involved in. Did you read that letter, and what's your take on it?
No, I didn't. You want to give me a brief summary, Jeremy? And I'll...
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, it was great. I mean, it starts off just saying, you know, President Trump, we were inspired by your 4th of July patriotism and by your military parade, and now we want... Yeah. Anyway, it was, yeah. Michael, for the record, is making gagging...
No!
No, I love it. Anyway, I thought the letter was great because it was so over the top that it's going to push some fence sitters into the sensible camp.
Well, do you guys know that there's apparently a counter letter in the works?
That's the one. That's the one I'm talking about.
The counter letter. Where did it appear?
It's out there. I can give
you
the link.
Was it explicitly a counter letter to the
letter?
Oh,
yeah, very much.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I want to see that. That's great. Yeah. No, I'm sorry. I haven't seen it yet. I was waiting for it to happen.
I'll show it to you.
And it's great. I think that's great. That's wonderful because, I mean, the point has been made. There is no consensus, folks.
Right. I mean, that was going to be what I was going to wrap up with. You're in D.C. here. Is there no consensus? You think that, I mean, is this something you glean from having traveled outside of D.C.? Because that's what most of the people I talk to tell me that, yeah, when they talk to state governments, when they talk to mayors, when they talk to, that's where they're hearing a lot of pushback on this, when they talk to Silicon Valley companies.
Oh, yeah, that's a really important point, Kaiser. I mean, it's not just in the United States, in Washington. I think there are differences of opinion, not so much within the Trump administration or on the Hill, apparently, but... As I've said, the signers of the letter show these people are all very active, very deeply involved and well-regarded people in international relations, foreign policy, China policy, et cetera. And they don't agree with this dominant Trump administration approach. But I think equally, if not more important, the U.S. public itself doesn't seem to buy into this kind of unvarnished demonization. When you look at polling in the American public, they express the greatest concern about China as an economic adversary.
Right.
And so they're concerned about economic competition, even though I think a lot of Americans recognize that most of the stuff they buy at pretty low prices at Walmart is made in China. But at the same time, I think Americans also are not as convinced that China is a national security threat of the size and the way that the United States, that the Trump administration currently defines it. And so I and several other people want to really take the open letter on the road. In essence, we want to go on a town hall tour of different cities in the United States, talking about the open letter and getting the views of Americans on the open letter and seeing what they think about China policy. So if there's anybody out there who has lots of money and they want to support us, get in touch with me.
Well, I don't have lots of money, but you have my warm body if you need it. Michael Swain, thank you so much for taking the time. I really enjoyed speaking with you. Let's move on to the recommendation segment of the show. But first, let me remind listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. Take a moment and subscribe to SubChina Access to start getting the daily newsletter written by our colleague Jeremy, delivered right to your inbox. Jeremy and his great team. Membership gets you an early version of this podcast, usually on Monday evenings, U.S. East Coast time, instead of on Thursday evenings, plus discounts to our conferences and free admission to our live shows. And, of course, a berth aboard our Slack channel where you can harangue Jeremy and myself and also take part in live chats with our frequent guests. So do sign up, show your support. Okay, on to recommendations. Jeremy, what do you have for us this week?
Okay, my two... part recommendation. The first is to people who haven't actually read the letter, please read the letter, because judging from some of the online response to it, it seemed pretty knee-jerk. And the letter is, you know, even though I won't sign it, I have my issues with it, it's very thoughtful. And I am definitely in the engagement camp. But my second recommendation is to Michael, you and your roadshow. I do think people in favor of engagement have to find a better way to respond to some of the concerns from people who you may completely disagree with, because a lot of it is perspective. I mean, you mentioned the Americans getting the benefits of cheap stuff at Walmart, but I know in my local Nashville Walmart, you know, I've overheard more than once people say, complain about cheap crap from China and why don't we make anything in the United States anymore? You know, these, I mean, that may be a caricature of a view, but these are real views, and we have to actually engage with those views too, not just the Communist Party.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, and this is... For all of us coastal elites, you know, I think we need to know how to talk to middle America better. We're just so
not bad. Only middle America, but the pissed off young entrepreneur in Beijing who's really mad because he got urine tested by the cops last night. You know, that guy isn't very receptive to being nice to China right now either. And those points of view are, you know, whether you think they're valid or not, they are making up the context and the environment in which all of this debate is happening.
Very good.
Sorry. That was more of a little preachy session than a recommendation.
Okay. A departure from our usual kind of fun and frivolous recommendations, but don't you have some bird app you wanted to recommend or something like that?
Yeah, anyway. Bird ID app and the tree ID app. I'll recommend those anytime.
Okay. All right, Michael, what do you have for us this week?
What do I have for you? Recommendation. Well, totally unrelated to China, I'm very much of an art buff, particularly paintings, and I recommend you all turn out to the National Gallery in Washington and go and see the current exhibit, which is on the pre-Raphaelites in the United States. They're associated with English painters, but there were a lot of American pre-Raphaelite painters as well, and I haven't gone there yet, but I'm hoping to get there. It's going to stop on July, I think, the 21st, so go out and look at art.
Oh, that's a great recommendation. I haven't been to the National Gallery in a long time. I need to get out there. I've got an artsy recommendation as well. It's the music of Anaïs Mitchell. She wrote the music for the multi-Tony Award-winning musical Hadestown, which is on Broadway right now, which I am seeing this week for the second time. Anaïs Mitchell is a singer-songwriter who does modern folk. She's basically everything you want in a modern folk performer, just achingly beautiful lyrics, a lovely, really versatile voice, just terrific arrangements. She's a very good guitar player herself. If you are in New York, do not miss Hadestown, which is a retelling of Orpheus and Eurydice, sort of set in a Great Depression kind of New Orleans-ish place. It was nominated, I think, for 14 Tonys, and it won 8, including Best Musical, which is some kind of a record. Anyway, full disclosure, my brother was one of the producers of the show. I'm taking my son to see it. I'm seeing it for the second time. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's so edifying. You come away just thinking, oh, they've just raised the bar on what you can do with musical theater. Anyway, do see it. Michael, thank you once again for joining us. We really look forward to speaking to you again.
Oh, great. I really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Jeremy, man, always great.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks, Kaiser.
And thank you for being so civil, even with your disagreements. I was a little worried. You dog.
Yes. Well, forward. Aluta continua.
All right, guys.
Bye-bye.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SupChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo, that's me, and Jeremy Goldcorn, that's him, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@supchina.com, follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SupChina News, and make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Session Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, our two shows focused on women, new voices, and Tafta, and of course, the Middle Earth Podcast on the culture industry in China. Thank you very much for listening. We'll see you next week. Take care.